When, however, the temperature rose to just above freezing point, as occasionally happened, the hut became the drainage pool of all the surrounding hills. Wilde was the first to notice it by remarking one morning that his sleeping bag was practically afloat. Other men examined theirs with a like result, so baling operations commenced forthwith. Stones were removed from the floor and a large hole dug, and in its gloomy depths the water could be seen rapidly rising. Using a saucepan for a baler, they baled out over 100 gallons of dirty water. The next day, 150 gallons were removed, the men taking it in turns to bale at intervals during the night. 160 more gallons were baled out during the next 24 hours, till one man rather pathetically remarked in his diary, "This is what nice, mild, high temperatures mean to us. No wonder we prefer the cold." Eventually, by removing a portion of one wall, a long channel was dug nearly down to the sea, completely solving the problem. Additional precautions were taken by digging away the snow which surrounded the hut after each blizzard, sometimes entirely obscuring it. A huge glacier across the bay behind the hut nearly put an end to the party. Enormous blocks of ice weighing many tons would break off and fall into the sea, the disturbance thus caused giving rise to great waves. One day Marston was outside the hut digging up the frozen seal for lunch with a pick, when a noise like an artillery barrage startled him. Looking up, he saw that one of these tremendous waves, over 30 feet high, was advancing rapidly across the bay, threatening to sweep hut and inhabitants into the sea. A hastily shouted warning brought the men tumbling out, but fortunately the loose ice which filled the bay damped the wave down so much that, though it flowed right under the hut, nothing was carried away. It was a narrow escape, though, as had they been washed into the sea, nothing could have saved them. Although they themselves gradually became accustomed to the darkness and the dirt, some entries in their diaries show that occasionally they could realize the conditions under which they were living. The hut grows more grimy every day. Everything is a sooty black. We have arrived at the limit where further increments from the smoking stove, blubber lamps, and cooking gear are unnoticed. It is at least comforting to feel that we can become no filthier. Our shingle floor will scarcely bear examination by strong light without causing even us to shudder and express our disapprobation at its state. Oil mixed with reindeer hair, bits of meat, sennegrass, and penguin feathers form a conglomeration which cements the stones together. From time to time we have a spring cleaning, but a fresh supply of flooring material is not always available, as all the shingle is frozen up and buried by deep rifts. Such is our home sweet home. All joints are aching through being compelled to lie on the hard, rubbly floor which forms our bedsteads. Again, later on, one writes, "Now that Wilde's window allows a shaft of light to enter our hut, one can begin to see things inside. Previously, one relied upon one's sense of touch, assisted by the remarks from those whose faces were inadvertently trodden on to guide one to the door. Looking down in the semi-darkness to the far end, one observes two very small smoky flares that dimly illuminate a row of 5, endeavouring to make time pass by reading or argument. These are Macklin, Carr, Wordy, Hudson and Blackborough, the last two being invalids. The centre of the hut is filled with the cases which do duty for the cook's bed, the meat and blubber boxes, and a mummified-looking object which is Lee's in his sleeping bag. The near end of the floor space is taken up with the stove, with Wilde and McElroy on one side and Hurley and James on the other. Marston occupies a hammock most of the night and day, which is slung across the entrance. As he is large and the entrance very small, he invariably gets bumped by those passing in and out. His vocabulary at such times is interesting. In the attic, formed by the two upturned boats, live 10 unkempt and careless lodgers, who drop boots, mitts, and other articles of apparel on the men below. Reindeer hairs rain down incessantly, day and night, with every movement that they make in their molting bags. These, with penguin feathers and a little grit from the floor, occasionally savour the hooshes. Thank heaven man is an adaptable brute. If we dwell sufficiently long in this hut, we are likely to alter our method of walking, for our ceiling, which is but 4 feet 6 inches high at its highest part, compels us to walk bent double or on all fours. Our doorway, Cheetham is just crawling in now, bringing a shower of snow with him, was originally a tent entrance. When one wishes to go out, he unties the cord securing the door and crawls or wriggles out, at the same time exclaiming, "Thank goodness I'm in the open air." This should suffice to describe the atmosphere inside the hut, only pleasant when charged with the overpowering yet appetizing smell of burning penguin steaks. From all parts there dangles an odd collection of blubbery garments hung up to dry, through which one crawls much as a chicken in an incubator. Our walls of tent canvas admit as much light as might be expected from a closed Venetian blind. It is astonishing how we have grown accustomed to inconveniences, and tolerate, at least, habits which a little time back were regarded with repugnance. We have no forks, but each man has a sheath knife and a spoon, the latter in many cases having been fashioned from a piece of box lid. The knife serves many purposes. With it we kill, skin, and cut up seals and penguins, cut blubber into strips for the fire, very carefully scrape the snow off our hut walls, and then, after a perfunctory rub with an oily penguin skin, use it at meals. We are as regardless of our grime and dirt as are the Eskimos. We have been unable to wash since we left the ship nearly 10 months ago. For one thing, we have no soap or towels, only bare necessities being brought with us. And again, had we possessed these articles, our supply of fuel would only permit us to melt enough ice for drinking purposes. Had one man washed, half a dozen others would have had to go without a drink all day. One cannot suck ice to relieve the thirst, as at these low temperatures it cracks the lips and blisters the tongue. Still, we are all very cheerful. During the whole of their stay on Elephant Island, the weather was described by Wilde as simply appalling. Stranded as they were on a narrow, sandy beach surrounded by high mountains, they saw little of the scanty sunshine during the brief intervals of clear sky. On most days the air was full of snowdrift blown from the adjacent heights. Elephant Island being practically on the outside edge of the pack, the winds which passed over the relatively warm ocean before reaching it clothed it in a constant pall of fog and snow. On April 25th, the day after I left for South Georgia, the island was beset by heavy pack ice, with snow and a wet mist. Next day was calmer, but on the 27th, to quote one of the diaries, they experienced the most wretched weather conceivable, raining all night and day and blowing hard, wet to the skin. The following day brought heavy fog and sleet, and a continuance of the blizzard. April ended with a terrific windstorm which nearly destroyed the hut. The one remaining tent had to be dismantled, the pole taken down, and the inhabitants had to lie flat all night under the icy canvas. This lasted well into May, and a typical May day is described as follows. A day of terrific winds threatening to dislodge our shelter. The wind is a succession of hurricane gusts that sweep down the glacier immediately south-southwest of us. Each gust heralds its approach by a low rumbling, which increases to a thunderous roar. Snow, stones, and gravel are flying about, and any gear left unweighted by very heavy stones is carried away to sea. Heavy bales of sennegrass and boxes of cooking gear were lifted bodily in the air and carried away out of sight. Once the wind carried off the floorcloth of a tent which 6 men were holding on to and shaking the snow off. These gusts often came with alarming suddenness and without any warning. Hussey was outside in the blizzard digging up the day's meat which had frozen to the ground when a gust caught him and drove him down the spit towards the sea. Fortunately, when he reached the softer sand and shingle below high water mark, he managed to stick his pick into the ground and hold on with both hands till the squall had passed. On one or two rare occasions they had fine, calm, clear days. The glow of the dying sun on the mountains and glaciers filled even the most materialistic of them with wonder and admiration. These days were sometimes succeeded by calm, clear nights, when, but for the cold, they would have stayed out on the sandy beach all night. About the middle of May a terrific blizzard sprang up, blowing from 60 to 90 miles an hour, and Wilde entertained grave fears for their hut. One curious feature noted in this blizzard was the fact that huge ice sheets as big as window panes and about a quarter of an inch thick were being hurled about by the wind, making it as dangerous to walk about outside as if one were in an avalanche of splintered glass. Still, these winds from the south and southwest, though invariably accompanied by snow and low temperatures, were welcome in that they drove the pack ice away from the immediate vicinity of the island, and so gave rise on each occasion to hopes of relief. Northeast winds, on the other hand, by filling the bays with ice and bringing thick, misty weather, made it impossible to hope for any ship to approach them. Towards the end of May, a period of dead calm set in, with ice closely packed all round the island. This gave place to northeast winds and mist, and at the beginning of June came another southwest blizzard with cold driving snow.